Welcome to Perfect Bound. I'm Jennifer Yaffe, the founder and publisher of Yaffe Press in Atlanta, Georgia. This is a podcast where we talk to artists about their journey, how they got where they are, what right and wrong turns they made along the way, and where they're heading next. Alex Soth is a photographer born and based in Minneapolis, Minnesota. He's published over 25 books, including Sleeping by the Mississippi, Niagara, Broken Manual, Songbook, I Know How Furiously Your Heart is Beating, and A Pound of Pictures. Soth has had over 50 solo exhibitions, including survey shows organized by Judah Poem in Paris, the Walker Art Center in Minnesota, and Media Space in London. Soth has been the recipient of numerous fellowships and awards, including the Guggenheim Fellowship. In 2008, Soth created Little Brown Mushroom, a multimedia enterprise focused on visual storytelling. Soth is represented by Sean Kelly in New York, Weinstein Hammond's Gallery in Minneapolis, Frankel Gallery in San Francisco, Look Gallery in Berlin, and is a member of Magnum Photos. Please welcome Alex Soth to the podcast.
Hello.
I figured it out.
First try.
All right. Here we go.
How's it going?
Good.
So we've met.
Yes, we have met.
Yes, we had, I don't know if you'd remember, but we had like coffee or breakfast.
Mm-hmm. I do remember, one point
in Athens. I remember the muffin being really delicious. Not so much what we talked about, but food usually sticks with me longer.
I don't know if that's a compliment.
It's not just you. It happens with everyone. And
you prefer Jennifer or Jen?
Jennifer.
Okay. Phew. Well, there's a professional person in my life who I would always address Jennifer, and then I realized like I was the only person in the world that called her that, you know. So
most people do it the other way.
Yeah.
And I grew up in Richmond, Virginia, and lived there my whole life, so I like didn't meet a lot of new people, you know. Mm-hmm. Like the people I went to elementary school with were the people I went to high school with, and everyone just always called me Jennifer. And a couple of times if someone would come over and call me Jen or Jenny, my mom would yell at them and like, that's not what we named her. And so when I went to college, which was in the north, mm-hmm. everyone shortens everything, and so I would introduce myself as Jennifer, and some I'm like, oh, I'm Jennifer, and someone would say, oh, hi, Jen, and I'd say right. Niffer, and then people started calling me Niffer.
Ah,
and that was
annoying.
That was hard to shake. Yeah, yeah. I was like, this is really going in the wrong direction.
Yeah.
So, but thanks for asking. So I hadn't originally planned to start the podcast this way, but I remembered about 20 minutes ago that Aaron Schumann wrote a bunch of stuff for Gathered Leaves,
mm-hmm.
for the back of those cards. And I interviewed him probably like 6 months ago now for the podcast. And I mm-hmm. never met him before, never spoken to him, and like fell in love with him, like declared him in the moment to be my best friend,
yeah.
uh-huh. you know? And
yeah,
I was like,
fantastic.
I was like, I'm not really giving you a chance to consent on this. This is just the dynamic of our situation.
Can you say
now.
That? Can
you... These days, it's a little tough, but
consent is an important word.
It is. We're here. But I was curious, like, what I loved about reading or rereading at this point, but I guess the first time I read it, I didn't know Aaron. And so rereading them 20 minutes ago was like these anecdotes and these little snippets of conversations. And I love the compilation of random sentences from emails from 2004 to 2015. And so it was like, I got a really good sense of Aaron and of you mm-hmm. through reading that, which was, felt really special. So I was curious how you've obviously had a relationship with him for a very long time. And I wanted to know more about how that started and kind of what the dynamic is.
Yeah. Well, I mean, one thing to know about me is that I have an awful memory. And so I definitely don't remember which muffin I had with you. and all of the past is murky. So I don't really know how it started with Aaron. I mean, way back in the day, I was big into blogging.
Mm-hmm.
And so my sense is that he I don't know if he was a blogger, but he was in that universe of people. And, you know, and the other thing is that I, you know, I live in Minnesota, so I'm not in the, you know, New York or London or whatever. Mm-hmm. So it was, I think it was a largely email relationship for a long time. And then we've done various events over the years. And I mean, he is, you know, as you know, an esteemed photographer and educator and all that stuff. So it's kind of weird that he's like my personal biographer at this point.
I know. I mean,
he knows more about me than I know about myself. Because
especially
I
with the memory problem.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. So, but it's really, it's fantastic. And it's fantastic to have that be a photographer. So someone who really understands what we're talking about.
Right. Yeah. He's just such a delight.
Yeah.
Oh my gosh.
By the way, are we in it now? Is this like, are we doing the podcast?
Oh yeah, it's all fair game now.
Okay. So you've declared your love for Aaron live.
True. Yes. Yes.
Okay.
Yes.
You're not editing that out.
No. I would say it over and over. Yes, but I edit them myself. So I try not to say too many stupid things that I have to later cut out. But it's tough.
The consent thing is going out for sure.
I don't know. So you just brought it up again, and I'm not that great an audio editor, so I have to leave it around. Anyway, he's wonderful. I'm glad you also agree. And he is just like such a thoughtful person. And like you said, him being a photographer, it just makes so much, you know, it's a wonderful dynamic. It was really, really, really enjoyed reading those pieces.
Oh, that's great.
It was exciting.
Yeah, and that's actually a good source of information. I forget about those cards. And recently I had to provide info to a writer, and that is a great source. I should have provided that.
Yeah, you should have just given the writer Aaron's number.
Exactly. Right. Yeah, or just have the camera off and have Aaron do this for me.
Exactly. So I want to talk mostly about your new work, and because that's the exciting stuff that you have coming out, and I've read a bunch about it and looked.
You probably haven't
it.
Seen that much, but
not in person at all.
Sorry, we didn't get you a book in time. You know, these global shipping problems, but.
I am very familiar with global shipping problems of books right now. It's troubling. But I was also reading a bunch of interviews that you've done in the past, and over time you've moved from being more focused on storytelling and the narrative to more of like kind of a stream of consciousness maybe approach to making work. And it seems to me that A Pound of Pictures, this new project, is the farthest kind of on that spectrum of going into that. So how do you agree? How do you feel about that? What's your take?
I don't necessarily agree. I mean, I think what happens is, I mean, I see it on a spectrum. Like I see the narrative on a spectrum and I just feel like it's this seesaw, and I just like keep going back and forth, and I never know if I'm in the sweet spot. And it's also related to accessibility. And I'm always struggling with how accessible I should make my work, you know, because I like that about photography. But at the same time, I want to challenge myself, and I want to challenge other people. I want it to be too easy. So I'm always like back and forth between things that are more experimental and more narrative, I guess. And this particular project took so many different turns. In fact, and you wouldn't know this, but it was a totally narrative project in the sense that it was to be published originally as a diary. So I was going to like chronicle the making of the pictures. That text was going to be right next to the images. And then eventually I abandoned that.
Why?
So the full backstory is that this started as a totally different project, which was about Abraham Lincoln's Abraham Lincoln's funeral train, and mm-hmm. I was following the route of his train, and that was going to be, I guess, you know, in the spirit of something like Sleeping by the Mississippi, mm-hmm. following a path and making work along it. Except that I had more constraints to it. I was going to photograph only at a certain time of day and a certain elevation, all these rules. And it all felt stifling in the end and enforced. And I abandoned mm-hmm. that. And then I started a new project from the ashes of that. And that was actually called A Box of Pictures. Mm-hmm. And the idea was that it was almost going to be like my midlife book of essays reflecting on the medium. You know, I'd seen people like Robert Adams and Stephen Shore write these books, these essay books. And I've had a desire to do something like that. Like I'd earned enough credibility to talk about the medium, and I was going to do it that way. And in terms of publishing the book, with Michael Mack, we talked about this diary, and mm-hmm. and then maybe there would be a separate book, which would just be like the strongest pictures, so you could see them on their own. But that diary book was going to have hundreds of photographs, and they would be smaller with tons of text. And then the pandemic hit, and suddenly, you know, there was like a year. It was like a diary and then a year. And then I was going to start again, but how was I going to acknowledge the pandemic, this big gap, everything that happened? It just like didn't make sense anymore. And so much had happened, obviously, during that mm-hmm. year besides the pandemic. You know, living in Minneapolis, Black Lives Matter, this stuff.
Yeah.
And it just seemed kind of ludicrous. And I couldn't solve that problem. So then mm-hmm. I had to kind of reboot again. And then it became much less narrative. Though, at the back of the book, there are these notes to a number of the photographs. Much like there are in Sleeping by the Mississippi and Niagara, my first two mm-hmm. books, which shows that tension I always have, like to tell the story, not to tell the story. And then I'm always like, oh, I'll hide it in the back. That's my solution.
It's worked. Yeah.
Well, it is one way to go about it. And mm-hmm. it's interesting to think of it in exhibition terms. 'Cause like the strategy that I've liked using the most there is not wall label text, but a sheet of paper that someone can carry around with them if they want to. So that ideally you can experience the work without that. And it's just an added layer for those people that want it or want to go deeper, I guess. Yeah.
When you'd said in the short film about the work that's mm-hmm. on the gallery sites, you say that like part of your practice is to pay attention to your own attention, which is interesting because to me, so I try to do these meditation apps very absolutely. Unsuccessfully uh-huh. for the most part, but that's what they're always saying is pay absolutely. Attention to your own attention. And when I've heard you speak a couple of times years ago, and you talk about that you had this kind of transformational meditative experience mm-hmm. that made you question how you approach photography and why you make it. So how would you say, was that kind of the shift where where you shifted from maybe trying to tell a story to looking at looking?
That's a really insightful question. And I haven't really, you know, talked about this new work, so I don't have a snappy answer to that. So I have to reflect on it. I do think, well, so what happened with that meditation experience that really shook up my whole creative process during that period of time, for sure. Mm-hmm. And then that actually became really non-narrative, I would say.
Okay.
Maybe that was the furthest reach. And, okay. And then,
and what work would you say represented that? Like what kind of,
I think the furthest reach was work that you've never seen, which is, this work I did in this, I bought this, this farmhouse and this abandoned farmhouse. Mm-hmm. And I did all this work out there. A lot of it was not even photographic. Some of it was like, I was making musical instruments out of the house and performing it. And mm-hmm. I was like building sculptures on the property. And I didn't even feel the need to document most of it. And, because in that state of mind, I was just going with the flow.
Right.
And, it was wonderful and I was super happy and everything's great. The problem was
your galleries were like, excuse me.
Yeah. 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 It's funny because my galleries were actually, supportive, amazingly, but,
they were like, he's going through something.
Right. But for myself, I felt no need to share it, it was almost like its own meditation practice. Mm-hmm. It was like, what's the point? And so it was a little bit of a crisis is a strong word, but I thought I reached a fork in the road where it's like, well, either I keep going that way and I'm basically kind of retired as an artist then, mm-hmm. In the financial sense, or sure. I continue to make a living and I have to kind of pull back into and take this back into photography. And that's what I did. I found my way back to making pictures again. But the further I went in that photographic path, mm-hmm. the further away I got from that other state of mind, because they are a little bit contradictory. Mm-hmm. And I've always felt this way. I feel that that this desire, you know, to like pin down experience is just like fundamentally opposed to like living in the moment. You
yes,
know?
Yes.
And
that's so true.
And this is annoying, and it's also a bit of a cliche, but I find that my photographic work is stronger when I struggle. And it's just a fact. Yeah. And for me. And God knows I've been struggling. So I'm not in that blissful state of mind, which is almost, it required almost like monastic devotion. So I'm in a very different place. But to long-winded, I think I have, in fact, applied some of what I learned to my photographic practice. And mm-hmm. I haven't even thought of it exactly in those terms, but it's true. And in the same way that I said that, like narrative is on a spectrum, I think that this kind of mindfulness or whatever you call it mm-hmm. is on a spectrum. And certainly applying that to my photographic practice is a good thing.
Right.
It's just taking it all the way is then it becomes no point in making pictures. It's
untenable.
Yeah.
Do you think that it applies to your portrait making practice? Because I had read like early on mm-hmm. you were kind of more assertive maybe.
Absolutely. With the,
and now you're more observant, just kind of letting it happen.
And again, I fluctuate mm-hmm. because one of the things during that time when I was really concerned with those issues, I stopped doing editorial work. And because editorial work, you have to get the picture, right?
Yeah.
You can't go back to the editor and say like, well, I felt like I was imposing my will.
Yeah. You know?
Yeah, you are imposing your will.
Right.
And so
that's what they're paying you for.
Yeah. So the moment I started doing that, that muscle was activated. Mm-hmm. And I'm always in a bit of a wrestling match with the ethics of portraiture for sure. Yeah.
How do you resolve that for yourself?
I don't think it can be resolved. I think there's always, well, I should say that at the point of taking the picture, I don't have a problem with it. Because I'm always getting consent.
I was going to say, that's an important part.
I'm almost...
I would like the record to state that I agree that consent is really important in all cases, even best friendship.
It's actually not entirely true. Also, I should say that sometimes people are further away, whatever. But if it's a true portrait, you know, there's consent involved. And very often, most often, it's a positive experience for the person I'm photographing. The problem comes later, the putting it out into the world and selling it.
Is it because you feel that that person just doesn't understand, in the moment when they're agreeing to have their picture made, they don't fully grasp what the full trajectory of this will look like?
Absolutely. Because just... almost nobody has the context for fine art photography as we know it. And you can explain it to them, but they don't really get it.
You're like, no, I'm really famous. This is going to be everywhere.
No, and of course, the thing is that, like, you know, 99% of the time, the picture ends up nowhere. It's just edited out.
You said I was going to be a big star.
Right. And in that sense, that's the easier part of editorial photography is like, it's going to be in this magazine, et cetera, et cetera. So for myself, it's like, well, it may end up on a gallery wall and then like, what's a gallery? And you know, like, it's different than a museum and it's for sale. And it's just like, no one understands. And, with my last project, I did explain all of that in advance of the photo shoot. So, because they were set up sessions and so the person could research me. So like everything could be known and then we're like done with that part of the conversation. You can't just on the fly when you're like driving around taking pictures, it's just too hard. And so I just, there's an ethical issue with that. And even when people, give full consent and all of that, there can be a change of mind later because, oh, I didn't think I was going to look like that or what have you. So,
yeah, no, I understand that. What image from this body of work left the deepest imprint or kind of stayed with you the most and why? I mean, you said that you included notes on some of the images in the book. Is there one or two that just really stick with you?
It's evolving because now what's happening is that I'm experiencing other people's responses and that's shaping my own experience and the my bad memory of the actual picture taking is beginning to drift away a little bit. A favorite picture is there's this photograph of a woman with flowers and she's sitting on the ground and this is in Oklahoma in Tulsa and it was just a magical experience the making of this picture. It came after a time period where I was really struggling. This is like once the world opened up again, I want to say the pandemic ended, but when I was able to travel again, I really struggled. And
why?
Then
in what way?
Yeah. And maybe we should talk about that because I think it's fun.
Talk about your struggle.
Well, I do think it's to me now fundamentally what this work is about is is my own neuroticism and getting away from it. So that's this like meditation element. And it's coming back to photography and to seeing and remembering how to do that over and over again. And to see like a beginner or like a beginning photography student, and to try to get to that place. which is
because you were kind of out of practice of it, or
well, because so in wanting to write these essays on photography, I want to speak positively about the medium. Like whenever I lecture, I try to check myself so I don't sound too jaded, because it's really easy to sound jaded. And you can say it's too many pictures in the world, Instagram's ruining everything or whatever. And then you realize that like photo students, they've just had their first experience in the darkroom. It's like magical. Mm-hmm. They're not worried about too many pictures or whatever. You're like, they're in loving it. And that's what it's about, is that place. And I think when photography is great for myself, all that falls away and I'm in that mindset. And so for me, what I'm trying to teach others is the thing I'm continually trying to teach myself, is getting to that place.
Mm-hmm, just this pure love.
Yeah, pure love, being in the moment and using the medium to sort of feel alive. Mm-hmm. And what happened with the pandemic is that, became closed down in my little bubble. It's all thinking in my head.
Yeah.
And a lot of it about these socio-political issues and economic issues, racial issues, everything. And so there's like swirl of stuff going on in my head. And then I go back out in the world and it's just like, oh, I can't take that picture. I can't take, why would I take that picture?
Right.
The world doesn't need to see that, and it's like all that stuff. And I had a breakdown. I mean, I like completely fell apart. And then I've worked my way out of it, and we can talk about that. But on that trip, I took that picture of that woman, which is, she may or may not be homeless. I don't know. She's gorgeous, and her face, I mean, there's like a beatific quality to her face, and she's loving being with these flowers, and that's okay. Like, I could enjoy that. And the picture just came together. It's not staged. It wouldn't be bad if it were staged, but it wasn't. And it fell together in this beautiful way. It looks like a Jeff Wall picture, and just happened. As I was taking it, I was like, oh my God, this is like so amazing. Like, I couldn't believe it. It was that kind of experience. It made me feel good about the medium. Again, like the putting it out in the world and then selling it for a bunch of money. Do I feel great about that? I don't know. Not necessarily.
But in that moment, it kind of all came together in the positive ways that you love.
Yeah.
And you said you had this breakdown, you worked your way out of it. What does that mean?
Yeah. So I was in, on that particular trip, I went alone. I mentioned that I would travel with young people, and that became a regular part of this project. But sometimes I would travel alone, and for that first trip, I needed to be alone because I was in my head so much. Mm-hmm. And so I went to Michigan, and
how are you picking the places? You were off the Lincoln.
Yeah, I was off the Lincoln path. But I would often follow a part of that route, and I would go to Springfield, Illinois. And anyway, how did I end up there? Like, what was I on about? I don't entirely remember the bad memory. just something took me that way.
Okay.
I guess. And I guess I did have this desire to maybe explore once again the Niagara region, because a part of this work was also exploring my past work and revisiting it with new eyes.
Okay.
And I was kind of thinking about heading that way, but Canada was closed. Anyway.
So you're in Michigan.
I'm in Michigan. And I just couldn't do it. I just like couldn't take a picture. And I kind of had a breakdown, and then I decided, I was going to go home, but I thought, well, instead I'll like go to some like rural place. And so I went on Airbnb and I found a llama farm that had a place to stay, which I thought was going to be really bucolic. Uh-huh. Turns out it was like right next to the freeway.
I have had similar high aspirations for unique Airbnbs that
exactly
turned out differently.
Uh-huh. I mean, it was perfectly nice, you know, mm-hmm. in case those llama farmers hear this. Right. Perfectly nice, but it didn't.
Yeah, you gave it a good review. It's
yeah,
good.
Right. It didn't restore my soul, and uh-huh. and then I was like, fuck it, I'll just go home. And then I had this other thought, which was, well, maybe I should just go south, because, you know, always in the north, there's like this dark. There's this darkness, mm-hmm. and I thought I'll go to Memphis in particular because I've always had good luck there.
Okay.
And it's like cliche and stupid as it is, Egglestonville, it's worked for me, so I'll mm-hmm. go. Mm-hmm. And I went there, and before taking any pictures, I was thinking about Eggleston. And I thought, I'll visit the Eggleston Trust, and I'll mm-hmm. visit Miss Winston Eggleston. So I reached out to him, and he's someone that I have encountered. I didn't know him well, but and I had just a fantastic time talking to him about all sorts of things in life and the lockdown and all of that. Mm-hmm. But I was also, you know, able to ask him questions about his dad, and in particular about his dad's approach to photography, which to me always seemed like the not neurotic. Like I always had the sense that Eggleston didn't worry about any ethical issues, or, you know, just wasn't concerned about how his pictures lived in the world. And so I asked Winston about this, and like I said, does your dad ever have, like, you know, sort of any self-doubt? Mm-hmm. And he was just like, nope. Not at all.
He's not human.
Yeah. Yeah. Right. And he said, like, you know, he basically every picture he takes, he thinks is good. Which is the spirit of The Democratic Forest, which is this book that I've, you know, been contemplating my whole photographic career.
Yeah.
And I thought, well, I'm just going to spend the day like pretending I'm that way and kind of pretending I'm Eggleston.
Okay. Yeah.
And driving around Memphis,
like
taking
pictures. Fake it till you make
it. Yeah. Fake it till you make it.
Mm-hmm.
And I went to this Buddhist temple, which is something I started doing a lot. Maybe it was right around that time, actually, because of that experience. But there are Buddhist temples everywhere. It's fascinating if you look on Google.
Yeah,
they're like, there will be like 15 in a state, and they'll be in like rural areas. They're everywhere. And so there's this one right in the middle of Memphis. And I went there, and there was this Buddha with all this like kind of shabby stuff around it. It looked like an Eggleston picture.
Okay.
And I loved it. Because I was making an Eggleston picture, but it was also about not, you know, the very subject, not thinking too much. And it kind of broke me open.
Mm-hmm.
And I took more pictures around Memphis, a number of which aren't aren't in the book, but that I loved taking, and the experience mm-hmm. was great. And that sort of liberated me once again.
Because you were in your own way.
Yeah, I was totally in my own way. Mm-hmm. I didn't photograph people yet, mm-hmm. But at least I was exposing film. Like, right, I couldn't even do that before.
Right.
And then I worked my way down, you know, further south, and then I was back at it again mm-hmm. after that.
Was the woman with the flowers the first portrait, maybe?
Maybe. That'd be
Let's
good.
Let's just say it was.
That'd be good. Yeah, good for the narrative.
Yeah, I think so. I think so.
I should revisit the how everything played out. Because this is the funny thing, is you make up stories and then over time they become real in your own uh-huh. memory.
Yeah, absolutely.
So, because I mean, what's really interesting is that this work is actually very similar in spirit to Sleeping by the Mississippi, because you might know this, but that project was something else before it, and it was called From Here to There, and the idea was that one picture led to the next, mm-hmm. and then it had a diary, and I have this diary, and in fact, in the first iteration of it, I exhibited the work with this diary next to it, and then later I changed it to Sleeping by the Mississippi, mm-hmm. And kind of attached that structure to it. I've since gone back and read that diary, and I have stuff wrong that I've said about Sleeping by the Mississippi for years, and it doesn't really matter.
Right.
But that's what happens. Yeah.
Right. No, for sure. So, you've been doing these live performances mm-hmm. or some on yeah. YouTube where you're kind of like a photo DJ mm-hmm. and, with found photos.
Yeah.
How does that connect with the Pound of Pictures work, and what made you want to expand the creative process in that way?
Jennifer, you've done excellent research for this.
Aww, thank you.
it's really nice. And this particular topic is very hard to talk about, because whenever I try to talk about this performance work, mm-hmm, mm-hmm. No one gets it. And understandably, you kind of have to see it to get it, because it's, mm-hmm. I say it's like DJing photos, but it's mm-hmm. not. It's I think more structured than that. But it's incredibly linked to this project. So what happened was, pre-pandemic, I was collecting snapshots as a part of A Pound of Pictures. And they weren't to be used in the final work itself, although they might have been used in the diary version of it. Mm-hmm. But this was part of my process, is collecting these pictures. And then what happened was I got approached by someone here locally in Minnesota about doing something performative, basically, and okay. with a musician.
Okay.
And a couple of things came together. So I had that collection of snapshots, but I also, simultaneous to that, I've been working on my lecture technique, basically. Because I've given so many lectures that over the years I've wanted to mix it up, and mm-hmm. and I've employed like chance encounters, and I'd started developing multiple lectures so that I could on a whim go a different direction with the lecture.
Okay.
And then most recently I developed a way of showing books and photographs live on the screen, so it wasn't a PDF, so that I could really be flexible and talk about different things. And I'd done one of these lectures here in Minneapolis, and it worked out well. So I thought, well, maybe I could use that technique mm-hmm. and use these found photos and do something. Mm-hmm. And so then she asked who I wanted to work with, and I suggested this guy, Dave King, who's a legendary drummer, but but also from Minnesota and my age. So it seemed like it would work that we could be in the same place. Cause this is not something we could do from opposite ends of the country. And then right at that moment, COVID hit. Mm-hmm. And it was perfect because we could be together. He wasn't on tour and we had all this time to just screw.
And everyone was looking at screens.
Everyone was looking
for things yeah. to look at for. Look
the,
at.
Yeah, there was that, but also it was at the beginning part of it. And so we just came here in this very room mm-hmm. and we just really experimented and screwed around and we're just like kids playing. Mm-hmm. And then a structure started emerging and basically like seven songs or movements that all function in different ways. And then we were able to do this live stream version of it. Mm-hmm. And then things opened up. We did one at Mass Mocha. And it's all about physical photographs and this also this question of like pinning down experience because the live event mm-hmm. is sort of the opposite of photography in a lot of ways.
Right. And so you were collecting the photos as part of the project, and the book comes with a couple of photos, right? Like reproductions of.
Right. So I was collecting photos. It's hard to explain this, but they were leading me places. They were like, I would find a photograph and it might suggest something and I would go explore it. Okay. And I was kind of using it that way. And then I got interested in the idea of collecting masses of photos. And mm-hmm. so I was buying tons of them.
Like on eBay?
On eBay, but not on... What I would do is I would find them on eBay and then I would ask the people on eBay if I could come visit them.
Oh, okay.
And
that's... You have the image of the man with the box.
The man in the box, actually, he's not one of those, but there's one of all these photographs on a table mm-hmm. with all the greenery. That's one of these eBay sellers.
Okay.
I spent all day at that house. They have a 500,000 photographs, and I spent the day, and I got through like 60,000.
Oh my gosh!
And what's amazing for that for photographers is just like I acquired so many photographs that are better than anything I will ever take in my whole life.
It's amazing.
That's so often the case with vernacular work. And it's like, what do you do with that information?
Right. That is humbling.
Yeah. And again, that's that like not thinking, you know, someone was not thinking. And made something completely amazing.
And probably maybe didn't know.
And didn't know. Yeah. No. And but does it have, can it be seen by others if it's not gathered into some sort of context or given shape? Mm-hmm. And I guess that is where photography as an art form comes from. It's the picture is the, it's a discrete experience and it may or may not involve thinking, but then the structuring of these things is so difficult. And that's where I say like, a monkey can take a great picture. It's not complicated. Mm-hmm. But like putting 50 pictures together in a meaningful way.
Yeah.
It's like freaking impossible.
I read that you collect vernacular ping pong photographs.
I did that. Yeah. That's where it started.
So random. And I love it. So do you have a special affinity for ping pong?
Yes, I love playing ping pong.
Okay.
And this speaks to that that beginner sensibility. Like, mm-hmm. I loved ping pong because I knew I would never be any good at it. And, you know, and like in Minnesota, I went to a ping pong club and thinking I was kind of good, and I was like the worst person in the whole club. and it's just infinite levels, and you just like don't care, and you just enjoy the game. Anyway, right. So I really got into it, and then started acquiring ping pong pictures just on a whim, and then published a book of those.
Did you really? I have not seen that.
It's pretty obscure. It's a Little Brown Mushroom book. Yeah. But Jeff Dyer, if you know his work, he's a big ping pong player.
Okay.
And so is Pico Iyer, who's another writer. And so in the book, it's Pico Iyer and Jeff Dyer who've played ping pong together.
And their names are kind of are
their
like
names
ping-pong-y.
Are like
ping pong.
Exactly. And what's fascinating though is that their ping pong philosophies are contradictory. So so Pico Iyer lives in Japan. He's very grounded, and Jeff Dyer is like super competitive. And like I've played ping pong in him. He wears like a little ping pong outfit, and he's like you know. And so this book was about that, and used my ping pong. I mean, it's like really obscure.
Wow. Yes. I love everything about that.
Yeah.
I have a soft spot for ping pong because I have just very low athletic ability in general. But in my 10th grade gym class, which was all female, we had these amazing athletes, like the star of the female basketball team, right, and the female volleyball team and the softball team. And we would do these units of basketball, softball, whatever.
Yeah.
And I was terrible at all of them. And then we had a ping pong unit, and my friend Jody Mandel and I were the doubles champion of our gym class. Like just a fluke, but it was like my one glorious, athletic moment. Yeah.
Yeah. Well, I've experienced something similar. and there are a lot of good ping pong photographers.
My gosh.
Part of it, I think, is
there should be a retreat.
Well, and so within Magnum, there are a number of them. And my theory is that war photographers are good at it because they often play while they're waiting. Anyway, so we had a big ping pong tournament within Magnum one time.
And
I won.
Wow.
Hate to brag.
but
it was beautiful.
Truth's the truth. Yeah. So there are questions that I always ask kind of at the end, and we're getting to that point because I've been rambling on.
I think I've been rambling.
The ping pong. I just had to know.
Oh yeah.
What has been the best career decision you've made?
Well, that one's easy. Because there was this moment when I was in my 20s, and I decided at a certain point that I wasn't going to make a living as a photographer, that it wasn't possible. I wasn't going to make a living as an artist, I should say.
Okay.
That seemed like too big of a dream. Mm-hmm. And so I came back to Minnesota, worked different jobs, worked in a dark room, hated darkroom work as a consequence, and thought it's going to be really dangerous if I make a living as a photographer that I'm going to hate photography.
Yeah.
And I got offered this job at a photo studio, a pretty high-end one. And I was way underqualified. I didn't have lighting skills or any of that, but it was good money. And I really struggled with that decision.
Whether you should take it or not.
Whether I should take it. Part of the reason I chose not to take it was because I thought I was underqualified. But the other part was this feeling, this like gut feeling that this was going to set me off on a path. And I'm sure it would have.
Mm-hmm.
And it was really like the road, split right there.
Yeah.
Thank God I took the other path. Yeah.
All right. That's good. It's nice when you can...
When you have an answer.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Can you talk about a wrong turn you made and what you learned from it?
Career-wise?
Hmm? I mean, it doesn't have to be, but.
You know, I don't have a ton of regrets or anything, but something comes to mind, which is I was listening to a podcast with the author John Green. I don't know if you know John Green. Mm-hmm. He's known as a young adult writer, The Fault of Our Stars, but he's but he's an amazing writer, and and he was asked this question about. The question was, when was a time in your life when you were inauthentic? You know, you were performing some other role.
Yeah.
And
great question.
Yeah. And the answers, this particular podcaster's asked this question often, and people often talk about like a time in high school and they dressed a certain way or what have you. Anyway, John Green talked about when he first got success and he went out and he bought these really great suits, you know, I don't know what they, Paul Smith or something like that, really expensive. And, and he just felt false in them, you know? And there was a similar moment around the time of Niagara, and I moved to Gagosian Gallery, and I was like, oh, should I get an apartment in New York? And I was like that was a path that I was starting to head down.
Yeah, and that you felt like was what you were supposed to do.
Yeah, and that I was
the circumstances and kind of
and wanting it a little bit, you know, like, and I was kind of performing it. And it was, yeah, it's like I think back to it, and I'm like, ugh, you know, and it was not the right. And I don't regret going to Gagosian. Sure. I kind of knew it wasn't the right fit, but you know, and it was all that stuff, that time period a little bit. Yeah. It was like I suddenly was the popular kid in school. And I, you know, I didn't like beat up any nerds.
Just shy of the nerd beating up. So that segues well into the last question, which is, how do you define success for yourself?
You know, continually finding ways to make it new, but also to keep making it. So, and that's, they're two different things. Like to keep, it's, I can't believe I still get to do this, but I get to do this in part because, I make a living at it, so I have to make certain sacrifices, creative sacrifices, whatever. If I go too far down that road, I get into trouble. But then I'm, you know, but I come back, I experiment, I goof around, I'll play with a musician, I'll collect ping pong pictures, do all these crazy things, and then I'll go and shoot a Gucci campaign over here. And for me, success is holding those two things in balance. And it's a delicate balance for sure.
Yeah. No, that's a, I mean, balance in general is hard in everything.
And that's kind of the answer to all of these questions. It's like about narrative, about meditation, about all this stuff. There is no answer. It's just like maintaining balance for a while until you lose it. And then getting back up again and trying to find some balance.
Ugh, so true. So true. Thank you for listening to the Perfect Bound podcast. I'm Jennifer Yaffe. You can listen to previous episodes by going onto the Yaffe Press website. You can also find this podcast on Spotify, Apple Podcasts, or any other podcast streaming platform. And if you love it, which I hope you do, please go onto one of those places and give it all the stars. Thank you so much again, and I'll see you next time. I was trying to think of what I would collect. And I love rainbows. And so I would imagine that a lot of people take pictures of rainbows.
They do, yeah.
Right? It would have to be more, it would have to be color photos.
Yeah, I've, I mean,
have you seen a lot of rainbow photos?
I've seen
kind of out there in the field.
I've seen a fair number, and I really like them as well.
Mm-hmm. Who doesn't love a rainbow?
Yeah. Well, what's interesting about a rainbow is it's kind of like the moon. It's like it's always something you want to photograph,
and
it's always it's a little disappointing when you do it.
So true.
So I like that, but that also gets at the problem with photography so often. And so what you'll see with the moon is that, you know, pro photographers will use these super telephotos to make it look giant.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, do you know about the moon illusion?
I'm not sure.
So the moon illusion is that, you know, when you see the moon and it's big,
mm-hmm.
that's your brain doing that. I don't know if you know this.
I didn't know that.
It's crazy. So, and I found this very hard to believe when I learned this. But if you like measure it with your thumbnail,
mm-hmm.
and then once it's small in the sky and you measure it with your thumbnail, it's the mm-hmm. same size. So what's happening is your brain is seeing it by the horizon and thinking it's large.
Yes. Yes, it is.
Yeah. And so, which is why when you take your iPhone, you take it like, wow, look at that big moon. You take a picture and it's
zoom it like 25.
Yeah. Yeah. But it's so small. Why is that? Which also gets at the problem with photography that
I was going to say the problem with my brain.
Yeah, but it's your brain is filling up the world with all this relevant information and making things extraordinary, but it's not really there.
Mm-hmm. Wow, that is. I'm going to have to sit with that a moment.
it's deep. I know.
Mm-hmm.
And check out, like, Google this, because there's some fascinating examples of it. And because I find it, I still don't believe it in a way.
Yeah.
And I have to relearn this.
Wow. No, I will.
Yeah.
I will.